Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
Matthew?
Right, what's going on?
Well, why don't you tell us you'd seen Mum on Thursday night?
Where's she gone?
We don't know. We've looked everywhere, phoned everyone. No one's seen them for days. We're going crazy here.
Okay, what's happening?
Why don't you tell us you'd seen them, Matt?
I told Sally.
No, you didn't. What time did they leave? Did they say where they were going?
Home. I thought they were going home.
Were they okay?
Did they seem all right?
They didn't say anything about going away.
Where's my mama?
Oh, Matthew, pull yourself together.
Matthew, I'm seeing you, Detective Constable Rob Nazarethan.
Narelle Fraser.
Ah, but that's not Narelle Fraser, is it? Of course not. It's actor Nikki Wendt, actually. She's playing Narelle in The Society Murders, a movie based on the murders of Paul King and his wife, Margaret Wales King. They were reported missing by Margaret's daughter in April 2002. Margaret and Paul were wealthy, happy, and firmly ensconced in Melbourne's most elite social circles, which made their disappearance intriguing. But the odd behaviour of Margaret's son Matthew and his wife Maritza turned the case into a media circus, breaking records for newspaper sales in Melbourne.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Narelle Fraser was a detective in the Victorian Missing Persons Squad in 2002, and later in this episode, she'll tell us what she thought of the movie based on the case. But first, Narelle steps us through the investigation, beginning with the initial phone call from the worried family.
Emma had reported them missing to the Melbourne police station on the 8th of April, which is the Monday. On the Sunday night, they've rung the whole family and nobody knows where they are. And so they all started ringing around. And it was interesting that on the Sunday night, they actually rang Matthew. And Matthew had said, no, I don't know where they are, haven't spoken to them. So Emma goes and reports them missing on the Monday, because by this stage the family know this is most unusual, because Paul's health was deteriorating very, very quickly to the point where Margaret couldn't go out a lot because Paul was needed a lot of care. Mm. So the family knew that there was something not right, because their mum just wouldn't, you know, up, and it's not like she could take Paul, yeah. I don't know, away on a holiday or something.
Yeah.
The Monday is when Sally reports it. The Monday night they have a meeting at home. This is before we've come on board. They have a meeting at home and trying to work out what's happened. And that's when we come on board the following morning, which is the Tuesday morning. We have a meeting at the Malvern Police Station. We meet them at about 9 o'clock.
What was their last known sighting at that stage of Margaret and Paul?
Well, funny you say that. It wasn't until the Monday night when all the family are together, and Emma has reported it by this stage, when Matthew says, well, somehow it came out that they'd been to Matthew's for dinner on the Thursday night. And the family were gobsmacked because they're saying, well, why didn't you tell us this before? It's such an important occasion. Like, that's the last time anybody's seen them, and Matthew hadn't said anything. So the family were very confused about that, a bit shocked, a bit bewildered, like, what is going on, Matthew? Why wouldn't you say that?
What were the sibling dynamics like?
I had a lot to do with the siblings. I found them all to be they were very close. Damien was living in Sydney. He'd married and was living in Sydney with his wife, and I think he had a couple of kids. The girls were very close, Sally, Emma and Prue. Matthew was really, from what I've seen and what the girls have told me or the family, that Matthew was really the black sheep of the family. Matthew, be it right or wrong, but Matthew always felt he didn't belong to the family. He felt like ostracised. He didn't feel included in a lot of things. And he became quite resentful of that, I think. But he was just, he was a different cat compared to all the others. Like, and I think he was also a bit, mummy's boy is the wrong way to really describe it, but Matthew could do no wrong in his mother's eyes. They had a business called Maritza's Imports in High Street, Armidale.
Mm-hmm.
But the family believed Matthew wasn't very good at managing his money.
Mm.
And he didn't really, they didn't think, probably couldn't run a business. He wasn't au fait with running a business.
Yeah.
So they were sort of struggling a little bit. And then after the imports, I think Matthew decided that he wanted to spend a bit more time with Maritza. He was getting a bit sick of being a house husband, and they looked at having a cafe. But he just, he wasn't savvy in marketing and business and all that sort of stuff. So I think the family were very, very hesitant, a bit nervous about him getting involved in businesses because they really didn't think he had the nous. Maritza's parents were Chilean.
Mm-hmm.
They came out here, oh, Maritza might have been, I don't know, maybe 10, 11, something like that. But they came out here, they lived in Boronia, in an average house, in an average street, in an average suburb.
Yep.
Whereas the Wales Kings, a completely different world.
Where did the money come from there? Did Margaret have money before she partnered up with Paul?
Oh, yes.
There's lots of money around both, yes. Right?
Yes, Margaret and her sister Di, Di Yeldman, they had a very, I'd have to say, privileged,
right, okay,
background. Margaret and her sister Di were really born into wealth, but
as were Margaret's kids.
Yeah, Matthew, I don't think there's any doubt that he was spoilt by his mum. In fact, I think the girls referred to him as the golden child.
Yeah.
Matthew could do no wrong, and Margaret showered Matthew with money, with anything he wanted.
Wow.
And he used to abuse that a lot, and the family, the siblings, didn't like it. Well, I wouldn't either. They all were very responsible with their money, and Matthew appeared to just sort of fritter it away, and he didn't sort of take any responsibility. And so, that and caused a bit of friction, as it would. We come in and we sit in a room and there's the whole family there except Matthew and Maritza. And apparently Matthew was too busy. He just couldn't make it. And I know the girls were just, and Damien, were just gobsmacked. Like Damien's come down from Sydney. But what I thought was amazing was they were a very, clearly a very close family. It was so out of the ordinary that they were missing. They were very distressed. They were very concerned, as you would expect, but you could tell they were close. But, you know, I think within probably the first half hour, the underlying, the current was there that they thought Matthew had something to do with it.
No.
Yep, within the first half hour, they intimated Matthew has got something to do with this.
Oh, my God.
And that was within the first half hour. And I could see they were struggling with that. They didn't actually want to think that, but it was a possibility. So that was the Tuesday.
Are they clinging on to hope that they're alive somewhere?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think any time that the homicide squad, that the missing persons unit come on board, you start to think, well, this isn't looking real good.
No.
What did you think? What was your gut instinct? You thought these people, this couple are not alive or?
I would think so. Yeah, from when we had the meeting with the family, and you just, you know, that gut feeling I talk about, but just talking to the family, you knew it wasn't just Margaret going, thinking, I'll have a night with Paul in a nice motel or taking him for a little bit of a holiday. She couldn't do that with Paul because he wasn't well enough. So we have the meeting with the family and we get all the facts and that we can. And we went around to the house with the family. We were looking to see if there was any disturbance, any signs of a disturbance, and there was nothing. You know, we went and spoke to the neighbours. We did all the standard stuff, the CCTV footage. I think there was an issue with the garage door. It wasn't locked, and that was a little bit unusual because Margaret would never go out. That was the only thing that was just a little bit off. But that's when we were around at the house, that's when Matthew came around. So we haven't seen Matthew until this point. And this is later on in the afternoon.
He came to their house while you were there. Yeah,
and we haven't met him yet. And as he walked in, it was like he'd sort of hit this wall and he just completely lost it. Mama, Mama, where's my Mama? You know, all this sort of stuff. Like, and it was, I actually felt embarrassed for him. I thought, Matthew, I know your mum's missing, but... Like, everyone has a different reaction, and I understand that. But to me, it was, like, over the top. And I think the family were a bit embarrassed as well. Mm. Like, you could – like, it was like, Matthew, you know, settle down a bit. It was way over the top. Mm. But you do try and keep an open mind and think, well, he could be very, very distressed. He was the baby of the family. You know, sometimes they just don't manage it as well, the youngest one. Anyway, but that was strange. And, you know, he didn't – the girls were asking him, tell the police about Thursday night, because by this stage they knew about Thursday night, and we did too, only just what they'd told us. Mm. So we're asking him about Thursday night, and he was very evasive and, where's my mama? Mama? You know, all this sort of stuff, like – we couldn't get any sense out of him, and then he'd say he couldn't remember, I'm not very good at this, I just can't think straight, all this. Anyway, he was only there, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes, if that. And he just said, I've got to go. So we then got crime scene around to see if there was, you know, we didn't believe that it looked like anything, there was any signs of a disturbance. We got crime scene around, you know, they check for blood and all that sort of stuff, not a thing. And they were pretty much convinced as well that whatever had happened, if it's happened, we're pretty sure by this stage something has, but we were pretty confident that it hadn't happened in that house. But, of course, now we've got the car missing, the Mercedes. So I think the following morning we do a media. We ask the family if they can come into Victoria Police Headquarters and if we can do a media conference to get the public to help us try and find the car. And it worked beautifully. Because probably within about an hour of, I think it was on the 6 o'clock news, by 7:40 p.m. on the night, that's the 10th of April, on that night at 7:40, we had somebody say, there's a car, a Mercedes, what you're looking for, I think it's in Page and Armstrong Street in Middle Park, I think it was.
Wow, okay.
And, of course, we ring up the locals, can you go around and have a look? Anyway, it's the car. So we got them to treat it as a crime scene. And that's when we rang Sally, because they were all around at Sally's. Everyone, except Matthew.
Except Matthew.
They were all around at Sally's, and we rang to say we found the car. We knew it was the car by this stage. And we actually thought the bodies would be in the boot.
Mm-hmm.
Just that... Mm-hmm. Oh, it was an awful feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we ring Sally and we told them that the car had been found. I know that Sally and the family felt in the pit of their stomach that the bodies would be in the boot, and I think I did too. And I remember Matthew said to Sally he couldn't come. And Sally basically, she stormed out of the car, went into the house and said, Matthew, you are coming with us. We've found the parent, our mum and dad's car, surely. And anyway, she basically dragged him into the car and they sort of hung around the corner. And anyway, we opened the boot and they weren't there. Mm. Oh, it was such a relief because I sort of felt they would be in the boot, to be honest, and I was very relieved that they weren't.
It's interesting you say that because I think, wouldn't there be a sense of relief that you'd found them, even though they were deceased, that it was, you know, to some extent over and now we get on with the investigation? But I suppose I've never found anyone in a boot, so I don't understand. You know, I don't know the dread that comes with thinking that could happen, you know.
I mean, it would have made it a lot easier for everyone in one way.
Yeah.
If they were there, because then at least it would all make sense and then we could start, like really the investigation would start then.
Yeah. So everyone's holding their breath, the boot's popped open, there's nothing in there.
No. We get crime scene out, they have a look, they find a few spots of blood. So they then put it on the back of a tow truck and they take it out to forensics to be tested. But the blood you can't really identify that quickly. It takes a while. But what they did the next day was nobody could work out the connection with Middle Park. So what the whole family did the next day, bar Matthew, is drive all around Middle Park trying to, get some feeling as to what have they done? Have they just gone for a walk? We checked the Spirit of Tasmania. We thought it's a long shot, but maybe they've gone on a cruise or something. You know, just bizarre.
Because you're assuming they've driven got to that point and then left their car. So where on earth would they go from there?
We found through that media, like this is only on the night of the media. So we found the car.
Wow.
And we've also got a statement from a solicitor, I think he was, it just lived around the corner, and he could tell us that it wasn't, that it was there on the 5th of April at 5 a.m.
Okay.
Now, the last time they were at Matthew's for dinner was the 4th of April.
Oh, yeah.
So the solicitor could tell us, because he walked his dog religiously, could tell us it was there at 5 a.m. on the 5th.
Wow. So we know that the car, Margaret's car, was there probably say 9 or 10 hours after Matthew's admitted that she was at his place.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that was the 10th of April. But I suppose now it's probably pertinent to go back to Matthew and the 4th of April because that's the last time. Are you happy to go back to there?
Yeah.
And we will do exactly that after this short break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, another one of our favourite former detectives, Charlie Bazzina, enters the investigation and makes a gruesome find. But first, Narelle takes us back to that fateful dinner party at Matthew and Maritza's house on the 4th of April 2002.
So, unbeknownst to anyone in the family, Margaret and Paul arrange with Matthew over the phone to go to dinner to his place on the Thursday night. Now, a couple of weeks before, he took some blood pressure tablets from his mother-in-law's cupboard. He asks his mum and Paul over for dinner on the Thursday night. Maritza's working at the shop. She gets home about 5:30, and by this stage, Matthew has made a vegetable soup and some sort of a risotto. That's what they're having for dinner. So what Matthew does is he crushes the blood pressure tablets and he puts the blood pressure tablets in the soup for Margaret and Paul. He doesn't have soup. It's only for Margaret and Paul. And they have their soup. He crushes them up, puts it in the soup. And anyway, things go along fine. They then have their main meal of their risotto. You know, they're sitting around, they've had a glass of wine. But apparently Matthew notices his mum starting to yawn, start to slur her words a bit. By this stage, he's also secreted a piece of 4x2 by the front door, where they walk out. So he's all got it all planned. And as they're sort of getting up, thinking about leaving, Maritza, this is the evidence that we have, Maritza goes upstairs to put Dom to bed. So Matthew sees out his mum and dad, mum and Paul. So as mum and Paul walk out, Paul walks out first, out the front door. Mum walks next. So Matthew's got the piece of 4x2. And as mum walks out, he gets the piece of 4x2 and whacks her across the back of the neck to the point where she falls over flat on her face. And he gives her a couple more whacks. And then Paul, it's a bit slow on the uptake. Paul, I don't think, had turned around by this stage, but Matthew takes a couple of steps and then bashes Paul across the head as well. Paul goes flat in his face. Anyway, he bashes them a bit more and he believes they're dead. Then Maritza comes downstairs. Dom's gone to sleep or whatever, and she walks downstairs and she walks out and she sees all the lights off and she sees Matthew at the front door. And she looks out and she sees Margaret and Paul on the ground, blood all around them. And like, it's like, Matthew, what have you done? And he says something like, get inside. And apparently she ran upstairs and vomited. So Matthew then chases her back upstairs and says something about, oh, I feel so relieved. He's looking for some sort of reassurance that he's done the right thing, but Maritza is beside herself. But then what's he get? You know, he's got the car to think about. He's got mum and dad on the ground. So he leaves Maritza and he goes downstairs and he drags mum and dad. He believes they're dead at this point, and he drags them over to a garden bed, which is just behind a big, I don't know, 6-foot-high fence right on Burke Road, Glen Iris. And he drags them to the front of the fence so nobody can see. But what Matthew sees is across the road is a girl. She's in, she lives on top of one of the shops that overlook Matthew's front yard. And as Matthew's dragging his parents over to the garden bed, he looks up and he sees this girl and she's on the phone. And she's looking straight at him. So he believes that he's been caught.
Mm.
But the girl just doesn't seem to do much, and he just, he says, I've got to do something. So then he gets the car and he drives it. He just drives. And he drives to Middle Park, parks the car, and starts to walk back along Beaconsfield Parade, I think, or something like that, gets a taxi home.
Is there any reason why he chose Middle Park?
I don't believe so. He didn't say.
Okay.
No.
So he gets a cab home. Maritza's still at home.
Maritza's still at home.
Mm.
And he goes upstairs and she's, you know, what have you done with the car? And so he says, you know, I've just, don't worry about it. So, of course, the two of them don't sleep.
You do wonder, did Maritza know, more about what was going to happen and that's why she went upstairs?
Yep.
Or was she genuinely completely gobsmacked that he'd actually done this?
For what it's worth, the family probably won't like this, but I had my own gut feeling is I think Maritza was telling the truth. The family don't agree with that and I understand that. But the evidence that I was presented with, that we were presented with, yes, you think of, did they, you know, corroborate and decide all this, but Matthew has never deviated from what he says, and neither has Maritza. Maritza, over the next 2 days, she was in a real quandary because she's saying, Matthew, you've got to go to the police about this. Like, they're going to come knocking on our door. And he kept saying, I just want to spend a bit more time with you and Dom. So what she was saying was she was in a bit of a quandary, I suppose, because, well, of course, because her husband is probably going to go to jail for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
She will be, if she tells the police, she's going to be responsible for that.
Yeah.
You know, when she's got her little boy to think about, forgetting all the family stuff, like you want to protect your husband.
I can't imagine what a bizarre twilight zone those few days must have been.
Yeah.
Because by this stage they're not reported missing. None of the other family members have really noticed yet, right, for a couple of days after the killing.
Nope, that's right.
So no one's come looking for them, and yet where are the bodies at this stage? Where are Maritza's?
Oh, the bodies are actually up in Marysville.
He's already taken them up there. Because they were in the garage, weren't they, for a couple of days.
Going back.
Yeah.
So he comes home that night, you know, oh, my God, what have I done? Oh, I feel so – and he's saying, I feel relief. It's all I can think about, relief that I don't have to put up with Mum and her domineering self. Anyway, so the following morning Maritza says, I've got to get out of here. I cannot be in this house. He takes her to work. This is the 5th of April, so this is the Friday morning. He goes and grabs a sheet from the linen press. He rips it in half and covers his parents' faces with it because he can't stand looking at them. He hires a trailer and he gets a de-shackle and he gets the trailer and puts it on the front lawn near where his parents are. He then goes to the Tate Timber Yard. And he gets some sash cord, some chain, and some more de-shackles. So he's quite organised, isn't he? Like, he knows what he's doing. He then goes to get some concrete bricks because apparently what he was going to do initially, what he was thinking of doing, was putting them in some water. He then gets two doona covers out of the linen press. He slides both bodies into the doona covers and he binds the bodies with sash, cord, chain, all that sort of stuff. He connects the bricks to the chains and puts them in the trailer. And he covers them with a deflated, one of Dom's, his little boy's deflated pools, right? So he puts the pool over it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then he moves the trailer from the front into the garage. Closes up the garage. It's all getting a bit hard. And that evening, Maritza comes home from work and he discusses at length what he's done that day and what he's going to do. And she said in her statement that she had no idea what to do. She didn't want to be there. She was panicking, all that sort of stuff, and she's worried about her little boy.
Yeah.
If I go to jail and Matt goes to jail, what am I, you know, what's going to happen with little Dom? Because by this stage, I think he's only about two. Following morning, they don't sleep, as you wouldn't. Off Matt takes Maritza to work because, again, she doesn't want to be there. She doesn't know what to do, but she just needs to get out of the house. On the way home, he stops at a hardware. He's doing a lot of hardware purchases, and he gets a mattock and some rope, and he gets a bottle of liquid magnate, which is a concrete cleaner. Uh-huh. At home, he puts all Mum and Dad's personal stuff, their watches, their earrings, all that. So he puts them, their clothes, he puts them in black plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
He rings his mother's phone at home. It's a bit of a ploy,
mm-hmm.
a deflection, I think they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, oh, Mum, Maritza's got a really bad headache. How many Panadeine Fort can I give her in one go? Something like that. And then at 1 p.m. off he goes with the trailer with Mum and Paul in the back. And he stops at the BP, local BP, and gets some petrol, as you do with Mum and Dad in the back. And he gets a map. And he has a bit of a look and he thinks Marysville. That's where I'll head. So he heads up towards Marysville, but not before he stops at Bunnings. I think he gets a crowbar and a couple of more digging implements. He finds an area and he digs and he digs and he digs. He puts Margaret in first, and he did this purposely and he told us later. He put Margaret in first and then he put Paul on the top, because Margaret had always dominated Paul and Matthew wanted Paul to dominate Margaret in her last moments. So he put Paul on the top. Anyway, he covers it up with, you know, all sorts of stuff. Gets rid of, he discards the black plastic bags and all that sort of stuff intermittently. So the following morning, which is the 7th of April, again, no one in the family is any the wiser at this point. So he then rearranges the garden bed because, of course, Mum and Paul have been on the garden bed. There might be blood, all sorts of stuff. So,
well, if he's thinking ahead to the extent that he's leaving a message on her answering machine, yeah, he's obviously now his thoughts have turned to trying to use this time to
cover his tracks.
Very calculated, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, very.
Like, he sounds like, from what you've said and what I've read, he wasn't a particular, like, a hugely intelligent person, or he struggled in life, but he sounds pretty cunning.
Well, funny you say that, because one of the psychs that saw him when he was convicted, I think his IQ was, let's say an average IQ is, I think, say, between 90 and 105, something like that. Well, his was something like 83. Okay. He wasn't...
A little bit lower than...
In fact, quite low.
Yeah.
But as you say, not too low.
Not, yeah.
That he can't start organising things and do the deflection with the phone call, get the D-shackles, organise, you know, everything. Mm. I mean, that's not too slow in my book.
No.
So, but what he does after rearranging the garden bed, he also orders another load. He orders a load of mulch for the garden bed because, of course, the mulch he's taken up, you know, to bury them with to help, he needs that replaced. So he orders some mulch. Again, it just shows he's not a fool.
No.
Now, that evening...
He's not a genius either. I mean, he's everywhere.
He's no genius.
No, he's buying, you know, digging implements and...
Yeah, and the reason we know that is because he's left a trail.
Of course.
So you're right.
Yeah.
So even when
he's
pays...
trying, but...
Yeah, he is trying. Mm. But we're too smart for that.
Yes.
Yeah. So that evening is the first time anyone contacts Matthew, and that's Sally. And she's saying, have you seen Mum and Paul? But he doesn't ring back because he doesn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And he's panicking a bit. But the next morning, which is now the 8th of April, he rings her. He rings Sally to say, I haven't seen Mum and Paul. He mentions nothing. Again, it shows that it might only be 83 on that scale.
Yeah.
But there's something... Something's works quite well because he's got the nous to order the mole. She's, you know, he rings Sally. Oh, no, nothing about Mum and Dad.
I don't know where they are, but doesn't mention that they were at his house for dinner on Thursday.
Or that he's buried them.
Certainly not.
No.
I wonder what made him finally mention that they had been at his house for dinner, because had he not, maybe...
Oh, I think it would have...
Would have come out?
Yeah, and I think looking back... There was Margaret had a diary at home, and I'm pretty sure it had in there Matt's dinner. Or something like that.
Okay.
Hey, you can't pull all over our eyes. No. We would have found out.
No, that's why I heard somewhere once, you can't plan a perfect murder. You can fluke one every now and then, but you can't plan one.
No,
All of these are classic cases of why.
Yeah.
Because these tiny... Of course, old ladies write on their calendar or write wherever they do, dinner at Matt's.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was a big indicator to us.
Hadn't mentioned it initially yet.
Wouldn't you say, I mean, if there was nothing wrong, wouldn't you say, oh, Mum and Dad were around at my place on Thursday night?
Yeah. Was there any truth to the rumour that they weren't dead when he... That he actually hadn't quite killed them?
Yes.
When he thought he had?
There was some indication that they may have been alive for, you know, 6 hours, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. I don't believe that they were killed outright.
Okay.
They, it would have been a... Well,
they would have been
horrendous.
Unconscious in the flower bed.
I believe they were unconscious. Yeah, but no, I don't believe they died until probably the following day. Yeah, hardly worth thinking about, is it?
Oh, it's terrible.
with 3 full days between the killing of his parents and anyone else noticing they were missing, Matthew grew restless.
He starts to think, oh, better, you know, make doubly sure that nobody will find them. So he returns to the gravesite with more soil and more rocks. He was concerned that maybe the animals might disrupt the remains.
Yeah.
This is where he made his mistake, because the rocks on top are the thing that the park ranger noticed was really, they were not just thrown there, like they were placed there. Yeah. He thought that was really strange. So anyway, he goes, puts the rocks on the top, and on the way home he stops at a car wash, completely cleans the car, he cleans the trailer, returns the trailer. That's when Sally rings him that evening and says, and he's just back from making sure everything's right, get your ass around here. Mum and Paul are missing. Emma's reported them missing. We need to find out what's happened. And that's when they find out. Then he says about the...
They were at my place for dinner.
Yes, okay. So the family, they're ringing everywhere. Nobody can find anything, and neither can we, mind you.
Because my memory is that pressure mounts on Matthew in a public way fairly early on. Like if...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if the siblings have said to you privately, we think Matthew has something to do with this,
yep,
in your first interview with them, yep, then it feels to me like the media is on top of Matthew pretty early on. Does that happen early in that same week?
Oh, yeah. Right. In fact, I think that happens days... yeah, so the media conference was on the 10th.
Yes, and that was the night you found the car?
Yeah, and from that night onwards,
right,
Matthew was on the front page every day, yeah, going in and out of his home.
Because he wasn't at the press conference and the media picked up on that. That was the point.
He wasn't anywhere, yeah, for anything, only when Sally or Emma or somebody would say, get your ass around here. Mm-hmm. So... the media on that with that media conference, that worked out quite well too, because we had the female opposite that was on the phone. She didn't see anything, and we know that because we know the time that he killed them was about 9:45 on the 4th. We know she was on the phone at 9:45 looking out the window.
That's right, yeah.
But she must have been so engrossed in her conversation. Yeah. However, she did ring the police later to say, I saw him cleaning out the garage with the water. So
a high-pressure hose or something?
So she did help us, but never saw anything on the night.
Wow.
The day after the media conference, we go to Matthew's house to do a cursory inspection. When we go into the garage, it smells like cleaning fluid. Like there's a really strong smell and it's like, one of those little ticks.
Yep.
Right? We also notice there's new mulch in the front garden. Anyway, so we ask Matt if he'll consent to us doing a forensic testing at the garage, and he says no problem. Crime scene finds some blood spots, but again, we don't know whose they are at this point, and it's not that quick. The turnaround isn't that quick that we know.
When does he finally break?
He didn't break for... He was under, as you said, he was under a lot of pressure. He was on the front page. Mm. I cannot imagine what was going on in behind those four walls with him and Maritza, with all that, because everywhere he went, he was photographed.
Yeah, he was on the news every night, walking in and out of the shop.
And look, we're doing lots and lots of stuff, but we don't have any evidence at this stage.
Mm.
But on the 29th of April, things change. So that's 2 weeks later, something like that. Everything changes because a ranger looks at those rocks. And he is an expert in lyrebird mounds. He's driving back to the office and he sees this mound and there's something not quite right. Mm. So he gets back to the office and he's still thinking about it. And he says to his boss, you know, I just saw something back there. Something's not right. It looked like a lyrebird mound, but I don't think it is. They do a little bit of digging and they find Paul. And that night, it was about midnight by the time that Charlie was the aunt, Charlie Bazina,
mm-hmm.
our dear friend Charlie, mm-hmm. he was on call and he gets called up there because they don't know who it is at this stage and it's one person. But they don't dig too much. They realise it's a body, so they wait and they get crime scene, you know, they get Charlie and then they get the crime scene. Anyway, that night at about midnight, Charlie rang me at home because I'd had a lot to do with the family, like taking statements about who was wearing what and all that. And Charlie says, do you remember what Paul was wearing? And whatever I said, Charlie said, it's him.
Mm.
So we knew we had Paul. But we didn't know until they did the excavation,
mm-hmm.
exhumation, that Margaret was underneath as well. So that's when we knew.
Here's a technical question.
Yes.
Is Paul's body left in that grave? Oh, well, how long is it left there while there's so much investigation going on around the grave? After the body's found, how long is it still in there before you lift that out and see Margaret below?
Well, I wasn't there, but it is a very intrinsic, like to...
Intricate, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Because you're looking for fibres, you're looking for fingerprints, you're looking for... I don't know, bottle tops, you're looking for...
insect activity, stuff like that.
All sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
So the forensics come out, not only crime scene, but mm. I imagine I wasn't there, but, you know, the bug lady, I don't know what do you call her, she is...
Entomologist,
She gets really excited about bugs in bodies.
Yes. Yeah.
She is an amazing woman. She would come out and, you know, look at... because she might be able to determine how long it had been there, all that sort of stuff. But I would think, I don't know, 5 hours, something like that.
Mm. Wow.
Mm.
Okay.
And because if you take him out too quickly, you may lose some really important evidence. So it's a very, very, painstaking work.
Yeah.
Mm.
Painstaking. So they don't find Margaret until, I don't know, at least a couple of hours later. And the one thing that stood out in my mind was Margaret was in a terrible mess, as Paul was, but Margaret had a ring on her finger. I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful but big diamond ring. And that proved to me this is not a burglary. Up until then, I probably... you've got to keep an open mind, but at that point my mind closed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought, no.
And the poor family. So did you make it to tell them before the media?
Yes, we did. Yeah, yeah. And they knew what was coming. We rang them and said we need to come out. You know, there is no easy way to tell somebody that you've found, you know, one of their, well, two in this case. It's hard enough with one.
In a shallow bush grave.
Oh.
I mean, that's like the ultimate sort of Australian horror story, isn't it?
But the interesting thing is we're at the family and they're all there, we've told them, and we say, look, we now need to get some DNA. We need to get DNA samples just to help with identification and all that.
Mm.
Everyone gives a DNA sample?
Except
Matthew. And I remember I was there when Matthew said no. You could have cut the air with a knife. They were just flabbergasted. They could not. Anyway, there was an almighty blue, as you would expect.
Mm-hmm. What was the reason that he gave?
He said he'd got solicitor's advice, and he had to protect his family. That was his reasoning. Now, whatever that means, I don't know. But I remember the family were like, why wouldn't you? The police need it to help identify mum and dad. Why wouldn't you?
Mm.
Anyway, there was a big blue and he walked out.
Mm.
Couldn't deal with it. Anyway, we go back to Matt's house and we do some more tests. Now that we've got evidence from the gravesite, we now want a nexus between the evidence at the gravesite and Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
So if we happen to find, say, a D-shackle the same as the one up on the gravesite at Matthew's house, or, I don't know, a doona cover that, you know, we're trying to find a nexus and evidence to connect him to the gravesite. Anyway, so what happens is we go through, I go through the linen cupboard and there's no doonas. Like, this is a family, a couple, and they've got no doonas, which I thought was really strange. They've only got the doona on the bed. But I also see a sheet, and the sheet matches the sheet that I've seen Margaret
wrapped in. Oh, wow.
Now, don't get me, you don't need to be a brilliant, it was just that everything started to fall into place.
Yeah.
We also found twine in his garage.
I mean, I'm getting shivers down my spine. Do the hairs on your neck just stand up when you're standing in his laundry and you see the sheet, the same pattern? Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, amazing.
I felt like screaming.
Yeah.
We also find a mattock and we think, that's strange. It's in the garage. We find some, we get crime scene out. They find some blood spots at the front door and we take away some new mulch that is at, on the garden bed. So what we end up doing is being able to match the mulch from the garden bed underneath the old stuff with the stuff he's put in the gravesite. All these connections, that is really good evidence. The bodies, they're being viewed by the family at the funeral home. Guess who doesn't view the bodies?
Matthew.
Yeah. Well, how could he, honestly?
Yeah, I know. He was a wreck.
Yeah.
They have the rosary before the funeral. Everyone's there.
Except Matthew.
Not Matthew. The funeral, Matthew doesn't sit with the family. Isn't that amazing?
That's weird. It's just totally.
But when you look at it now, it is just so obvious.
Yeah.
But
because how could you? How could you go?
Body language is not evidence, but you think, come on.
And it must have been so horrible for the rest of the children to just be going through that trauma and then really knowing in their guts that their brother's done something.
I think they knew by this stage that it was him. But also another thing was the wake.
Yeah, didn't go.
Doesn't go the wake for his own parents.
So when did he?
Yeah.
When did he crack? I mean, did he realise and come to you, to police, or did you go to him with the evidence?
We went to him.
Right.
So what happens is the day after the funeral, Maritza can't live with herself anymore.
No, good on her.
Okay. She goes to Phil Dunn, unbeknownst to Matthew. Phil Dunn is a QC. She goes to him, unbeknownst to Matthew, and says, I can't live with myself anymore. This is what happened. Phil Dunn then comes to us and says, this is what we've got. I don't know what happens, but the bosses at homicide and Phil Dunn, they, it's not a deal, but
they negotiate something.
They negotiate.
Okay.
Whether you agree with that or not, it's a way that we've got to somehow get Matthew to talk. In the warrant on his house, we find some crushed tablets behind the sauce bottle, not all of the blood pressure tablets, some a little bit had been leaked. We actually found some powder from the crushed tablets on one of his on the chopping board. Like, amazing stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was really good. The liquid magnate, we found where he'd purchased that, all that sort of stuff. He was arrested on the 11th of May.
Sorry, he must have just been waiting like each day thinking, when am I going to get picked
up? But when you've got a murder, like the Supreme Court, it's big time. You have got to have every T crossed, every I dotted.
Yeah, it can't just be, well, it's obvious, I guess. You know, that's where I'd be. Well, it's obvious, isn't it? I mean, look at him.
He looks like a murderer.
He's crazy, this bloke. So, I mean, given that, again, the pressure that's been on him for such a...
Didn't take much, to be honest.
How much did it take?
Not much.
Okay.
No.
He finds himself finally in an interview room, which I imagine would be a pretty intimidating place to be at the best of times, let alone when you know you've killed your parents.
Yeah. Half the time, when people come in and it's been fairly... it's been a while. The pressure has built up, and I think a lot of times it's like a relief for them,
yes,
and that they can actually tell someone and get it off their chest.
Yeah.
I think all along Matthew was going to admit it, but he always said he was trying to bide time so that he could spend more time with Maritza and Dom, because he knew he was.
Yeah.
I think Matthew knew he was going to get caught. Mm. It was just a matter of when. But he stated in the interview that he killed his mum because he had a deep-seated hurt that he'd felt since childhood, that his mother had ostracised him, belittled him, made him feel dumb in front of his siblings, and he hated the way that he believed his mother used money as a bargaining tool, as a leverage, to dominate him.
Because his siblings hated the way she kept giving him money and bailing him out.
But Maritza attended St Kilda Road. She, you know, told us everything. She was charged with perverting the course of justice for making the false statement, because she made a statement that was completely false about seeing them off, never said anything about seeing them dead. And she got a 2-year suspended sentence. Now,
okay, family fair.
She doesn't
about
get
that.
Charged mm-hmm. with being an accessory.
Wow.
Because married people cannot be charged as an accessory. There is a section in the Crimes Act, it's either 338 or 383, but what it says is that a married person can't be an accessory to any indictable offence, including murder, if they are comforting, relieving, what are the other words, assisting, receiving.
Wow.
But they've got to be married. Now, also, Matt saw a psychologist or a psychiatrist called Ian Joblin. This is for court. And Ian Joblin, he actually said that he didn't think Matt was quite right. He was disappointed. He thought the family would think he was just, you know, thank you so much for getting rid of Mum.
No.
Really?
Yeah, he could not get over the fact that they were shocked and didn't want anything to do with him. He thought they would thank him. Hey, I'd love to finish off on this.
Yes.
Of course.
It's an excerpt from a speech that was given at the 70th anniversary of the Homicide Squad. It was given by Detective Inspector John Potter. And it resonated with me. It was one of the most beautiful speeches I have ever heard. It still affects me to this day, and I thought it was a nice way to finish off. The pride I felt at the time hearing it, even now when I say it, it could almost, you know, bring me to tears.
Oh,
but he was also quoting from a speech by, what's the person's name? Professor Ali Wiesel, who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. So,
he wrote the book Night.
So he was a Holocaust survivor.
So please don't ever think this is me, but this I just thought it was beautiful. So this is what John Potter said at the anniversary dinner. This is just a few points he made. When people are at their absolute worst, Homicide Squad detectives need to be at their absolute best. Often at those times when the hours have been long and the pressure to produce at its peak. You represent victims and victims' families in an environment where they often have no voice. You step up day after day to all manner of things, sometimes in the face of extreme anguish and suffering. You revel in establishing that nexus between an offence and an offender. That small thing that you know will solve the case. Conversely, you hate failure. You judge failure by an unsolved case, a dismissal at court, and worse of all, by an inability to lay a charge when you know who your offender is. You engage well with people from all walks of life. You provide a degree of humanity to the anguish of a distressed and grieving family. You revel in justice, but understand you can never produce closure. The end.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it is. And it's just sort of, it reminds me of that whenever I've spoken to you guys, by which I mean detectives, homicide detectives, I just always, you come away with this bittersweet kind of Particularly when you've solved a case. Yeah. You did it.
Yeah.
But the person's still gone and the family's still without. Grieving. And the perpetrator's still made a terrible mistake and none of that comes back. None of that's fixed when you solve it.
I just thought that was
So what did Narelle think of the movie about the case? I'll let her tell you in a second, after I thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime and thank Bart Heeran and Sound City Studios in Spotswood for recording it. Please take a second to give us a nice review wherever you get your podcasts so that other people can find us. And now it's back to Narelle for her movie review.
Do you know that there was a telly movie made about this?
Yeah.
And my part was played by Nikki Wendt.
Was it?
Yes.
God, you've got to be happy with that.
Well, I was going to say it was a win-win for me because at the time she was 10 years younger than me. She was 10 kilos lighter and pretty damn hot.
She is stunning and a great actor.
In fact, the resemblance is uncanny. Blonde. Yeah, yes. She's yeah. I'm so blonde.
I get it. Yeah. I mean, I've got the horn just looking at you now. I'll cut that out.
But also Naz's part.
Yeah. Did they have your right names, by the way?
Yeah,
was she Narelle Fraser?
Yeah. It was the most bizarre thing.
I'm going to watch that now. I've never watched it before.
To watch a telly movie where starring Nikki Wendt as Narelle Fraser.
Oh, that is weird. Yeah.
And it was bizarre.